I'm Steve Martin, your host for Unreal Bluegrass. Coming up, I had the opportunity and wanted very much to catch up with Peter Wernick, Dr. Banjo. He had a heart attack several weeks ago, and I will tell you this, it's very encouraging. Pete sounds great. He sounds like he's always sounded to me. I know he's making a nice recovery, but I let him decide how long we would talk, and we had a lot to catch up on, and Pete's very active still. He'll tell you all about it. I'm going to start off this part of the program with a tune that Pete wrote from his father's point of view, directed at his mother, the wife of his father. The tune is called Ruthie. I love the passion that Pete Wernick puts in this. Remember, it's just a very, very personal song. I think other people have recorded it, but I like this version. We'll come back with some Plexigrass in the middle of our conversation, and we'll finish it up with another one from Hot Rise. There's so much music when you start talking about getting a higher level look at Pete Wernick and what he's doing and what he's done and what he's going to do. Thanks so much for tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass. I would be awfully lonely if you did not. To the listeners of Unreal Bluegrass, I have a frequent contributor to Unreal Bluegrass. I will do it this way. He is an educator. He is a banjo player. He's a great musician. He is a mentor to me and thousands of other people who play banjos. And he's just a really nice guy. He's a doctor, Dr. Banjo, Peter Wernick. How are you, Doc?
Well, I'm pretty good, I'm glad to say.
Well, I'm glad. By the way, I also include you not just as a mentor, but I also include Pete Wernick as a friend over the years. We've known each other for quite a while.
Yeah. We seem to have a lot in common, and the fact that you show up at various events that I'm at helps everything along.
Yeah, it's just one big continuous stream, I guess, of connection. I figured we might want to give the listeners an update. Pete, I read that several weeks ago, maybe a month ago by now, that you had a heart attack. I want people to hear from you how you're doing, and I want to talk about some things that you're going onward and upward with. So, first of all, if you want to talk a little bit about what happened, we talked about this last week, and I thought, well, maybe you want to know.
We weren't recording then. Well, today's the last day of February, and on the very first few hours of February, I was up and had symptoms that I recognized from lists of things to watch out for. And it wasn't distressing in the way a crushing chest feeling would be or passing out or anything. It was pretty low drama. But I knew I had to call the doctor, and he said, go to the emergency room, which I did, and went to the ICU, and within a few days I had had angioplasty, which is when they put just this tiny little balloon right into the artery that was, in this case, 100% blocked, and they kind of shove some of the plaque out of the way and stick in stents, which I now have, and then the blood flow comes in, and it led to a kind of a hairy episode where the heart wasn't quite ready for the blood flow, and if there's anybody medical out there, I went into what's called VTAC, which is the heart really not happy, as they say.
Oh, really?
And I didn't pass out, but it was considered pretty serious, and they gave me electric shocks to stop this AFib component of it, and that didn't work, although it was memorable. and then they got medications into me that just stabilized everything, and it has been like that for over 3 weeks, and I got to go home almost 3 weeks ago, and it was sort of an interesting, you might say, experience, although some people figured it was probably extremely distressing, and
I don't know that.
Strange to say that I wasn't especially distressed, except saying I had a heart attack just didn't sound like something I could or would ever say. And then on the other hand, my dad, who I take after genetically, he had a heart attack at about the same age. And one nice thing is when I had just had a checkup that led to an angiogram where they look into your heart, and they spotted what was to become the 100% blockage, but it was only 50% back then, and I was just told you got to start working out, get on a regimen. So I did. I've been working out other than the first year of COVID. I'm doing pretty strenuous workout 3 days a week, and my doctor said that that had a lot to do with how well I did in general, because the blocked artery had what they call collaterals. Now, this is getting a little,
maybe too much information. No. This is an amazing thing that I've learned about over the years. You're talking about collateral circulation, where there's these little tiny arteries that are there, they're already there, and if there's blockage, the blood goes another way. Now, it's not as efficient.
That's right.
But, yeah.
That's right, and that's probably, if I hadn't been working out all that time, I imagine it could have been a lot more serious. And so I'm glad I just, you know, got a checkup when I was a little past 60 years old, and I was expecting to pass with flying colors, and they said, better... you know, they did this angiogram, and then I found out about blockages, and took it pretty seriously. So, I like sharing this kind of stuff because it could be a word to the wise.
Exactly.
Your workouts,
right?
You know, I had a good supervisor who just understood my needs, and it was a socially enjoyable time to be there with a few other people. And also, it's good to for a person like me, who can stay in the house almost 100% of the time, to get out of the house a few times a week to do something positive. And that was good for my mental health as well as my physical health. And I'm soon to start cardio rehab, so I'll be back into a kind of a workout situation. Yeah.
I was going to ask you about what rehab you have scheduled. It sounds like you're
That's
about
it.
Ready. Yeah, okay.
And now, it's conveniently located.
Okay,
I'm also going to be working out my hands, because one of the first things I checked when I could is, can I still play the banjo? And I can. And but I have a gig coming up in about 5 weeks, just a Denver gig not far away, where I'm expected to play a half-hour solo set, which I'm looking forward to. I don't know if you've ever heard of the name Dick Weissman, but he is a friend who is in his late 80s, who lives in Denver, and he's still relatively youthful, and he's on a lot of recordings, some of the old folk samplers that were out in the 60s, and he was in a pretty famous folk group called the Journeymen.
Oh, sure.
And he's still at it, and he coordinated this gig, so... that's my first gig, and then the next weekend, I just okayed an arrangement with Bill Evans, a good friend, who has moved to New Mexico, and he's running banjo camps down there, and I had ceased doing banjo camps in 2015 just because they were using up so much of my January. I just decided to let it go, especially because... in general, banjo camps have an important weakness, which is getting 25 banjo players together. I mean, you've seen the cartoons and all that.
Yes.
But,
well, I first met you at a banjo camp with Bill.
Yeah, that's true. With the Sonny Osborne.
Yeah, that's
one,
right.
If I'm thinking right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's the thing. Bluegrass is a team sport, and if you're going to play bluegrass banjo, you got to be on a team, and you got to practice teamwork. And a lot of banjo players, I know this for a fact, play by themselves, and they hardly ever play with other people. And I realized that I was more likely to recommend to a new banjo player that they get in a jam camp where they could take what skills they had and learn timing and learn chord changing and learn about singing and learn about just the way you function on a team. And I'm big on analogies, and I said, you know, just because a person goes to the batting cage doesn't mean they're a baseball player. If somebody says, oh, well, I'm a second baseman, I say, oh, you're on a team, and they say, no, I just watch films about second base, and I've read books about being a second baseman. I'm thinking, that's not being a second baseman.
Exactly.
You really have to know the teamwork. Your second baseman involves a lot of teamwork, and so does being a banjo player. So we, at jam camps, do things that a private teacher would never know how to do, which is to how to adjust volume according to whom you're backing up and how loud they are. And so I was already doing jam camps, but I found it more helpful to people to give them a way to jam with other people and still get coaching, so that if I realized somebody didn't have their roles synchronized or they were not playing the melody, I could still coach them about that. And with a banjo camp, I was always just working on fine-tuning skills, like, you know, like, say, so a batting coach at the batting cage.
Right.
And I'm not saying it's not valuable, but the nighttime jamming, sure, at an all-banjo camp is nowhere near the fun that it is at a jam camp, where there's all the different instruments.
Well, I was going to say, being in the same room with 30 banjos after midnight can be kind of rough.
Yeah, or even before midnight.
Before midnight, yeah.
I mean, I've been part of... Ken Perlman is a friend of mine from when we were both at Cornell in the 70s. And he's a wonderful banjo player in the Clawhammer style, and he's a good organizer. So he's organized quite a few banjo camps, and I've been invited to a fair number of them. And one of the things that I kind of rebelled against was getting assigned to be in charge of a jam at 9 o'clock at night when I was already exhausted. And there's 10 guys standing in a circle playing ground speed, and I'm thinking, that's not the music I like to play. You know, it's good to have the other instruments there. There's a reason, just like there's a reason not to have all second basemen show up at a baseball practice. You know,
I agree.
So anyway, you know, so the very next week after I'm doing the camp with Bill, and I should mention, it's in New Mexico at a beautiful place, and it's not very large. They limit it to 25 people.
Okay.
And Alan Mundy's going to be there, one of my favorite people, as well as one of my favorite banjo players.
100% with you on that.
Yeah, well, me and Bill and Alan are going to have fun together and also do the teaching. And Joan, my wife, is coming along, and she'll help facilitate some jamming. And I'm just looking forward to it so much. And Bill just informed me that since I just was able to agree to do this, he's just starting to publicize it now. So there's room in it. And if you fly into El Paso or Albuquerque, you're a mere 3 hours away from Kingston, New Mexico, where this thing is. But that's a place that a lot of people have used, in fact, to run smallish camps. And that'll be my first out-of-state outing in quite a while. And that's like the third weekend of April. And on Sunday is Easter, and Bill and his wife are actually going to do an Easter service on that day, which you got to say is unique for a banjo camp. That's not too common. So anyway, I'm really looking forward to that. And immediately following that, I'm doing my flagship jam camp, which is in North Carolina right before Merlefest. And Joan and I are playing at Merlefest, too. My April is now shaping up as something.
Oh, that's great. And I tell you, you sound great. I talked to you last week, and I thought, boy, he sounds so... Of course, he always sounds good. Pete always has a lot to say, but I'm so glad you sound... I can't see you, but you sound like you're ready to get back at the game.
Yeah, I'm eager. You know, just COVID made everybody eager because, my main activity... I'm more now of a mentor to teachers than I am anything else in my career. I mean, I still occasionally have a hot rise gig, and Joan and I play out, and so does my Flexigrass band, and I'm in a traditional bluegrass band around here that's really good called Long Road Home. So, but none of these groups work very much, but what I spend most of my days doing is staying in touch with what we call the home office, in the Wernick Method land, where I have two really good employees in Raleigh, North Carolina, and we are in constant touch. And we've got my website in better shape than it's ever been.
Okay.
And there's a lot of articles there that are free. And I have 66 banjo newsletter columns that cover everything from my adoration of Pete Seeger and Earl Scruggs to how to keep your banjo in tune. That took two columns to write about it. because there, I have a lot of tricks about that, and also how to deal with stage fright, which is one of the most difficult things that a lot of banjo players have to deal with, no matter how much they know. Can they execute when the chips are down? And it's not easy, and I know some good tips. So there's a lot of that stuff on
the
website. And
yeah, is it Dr. Banjo, or just, or we look for Peter Warnick?
It's drbanjo.com.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And there's videos of me playing with all kinds of different people and blah, blah, blah. So it's intended to be a real banjo resource. And there's also quite a bit of stuff about jamming on there as well, you know.
Well, you've had for a long time those jam etiquette rules, so to speak, as to how to participate
yeah.
in one. Yeah. That, and I think if you read through them, they make a lot of sense, and if people can follow those things, it'll make
yeah,
it more
there's
pleasure.
A lot of stuff online and things I've come across that, like the 10 rules of jamming or the 10 jamandments and stuff. But I said about making a actually thorough version of the ground rules, you might say, and the etiquette, what to expect at a jam session. And a lot of stuff is done sort of silently or in body language or some kind of code. And if you first come across a jam and all you've been is a closet player, this happens a lot, in fact, a person who's been taking lessons for 2 years and can get through 10 songs in tablature is told that, oh, you should go to a jam. So they go to a jam, and they realize they know nothing about how to participate, and it gets them nervous. And then when they try to play one of the things they know, they clutch, and they have a bad time. And what actually happens, and I know this to be true, that's enough to stop somebody's involvement with the instrument because they figure they're just not cut out for it. And that's really not their fault. It's the fault of poor teaching. So I've been teaching since I was in my teens, and I'm 76 now. So I've learned a lot about teaching, and my methods are streamlined where the two criteria are fun and results. If you're only having one of those, that ain't right. You know, got to have some fun, or why are you doing it? And if you don't have results, that means you're not... Maybe you can't even play in time, or
yeah.
you can only play in one key or something.
We're going to continue our discussion right now with Pete. So happy to have Dr. Banjo back on Unreal Bluegrass. When we conclude the discussion, we'll play High on a Mountain, which is an absolute Hot Rise classic, in my opinion. Thanks so much for tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass. I'm talking to Pete Warnick, if you're just tuning in. I have so many books that you put together, I'll say back in the 70s and maybe later than that, but one of your teaching books, I know you worked on the Masters of the Five String. Didn't you participate in that, putting
it
together?
Oh, yes. I didn't just participate.
Yeah.
It was my idea originally.
Yeah. And the Bluegrass,
hard on that
the Bluegrass Song, yeah, the Bluegrass Songbook?
Yeah.
That was
quite an opus back in the 70s, and it's sold very well.
And it's a great... These are great things to have, because you can say, oh, I didn't know... Sometimes you hear a song and you play it, but this is not necessarily musical notation, because I have it. It'll be lyrics with the chords over the lyrics. It's not tablature, but if you ever wanted to know what was really being said and maybe what the real changes were, it's a great book, almost everything. You can find almost everything in there.
I was very proud of that book, because they did a number of things that were breakthroughs. One is, it's the only book still that has a lot of instruction about bluegrass singing, which is the most important thing in bluegrass, if you ask almost anybody who's been playing it for a while. It's not centered on any one instrument, but it's certainly centered on songs. And if you've got a good singer in the group, or if you're a good singer at a jam session, that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
And so who better to learn from than, say, things that Jimmy Martin says about singing, or Ralph
yes.
Stanley, or Lester Flatt, or Hazel Dickens. And I interviewed all these people back in the 70s and put in the best excerpts, and pretty much all the main singers of bluegrass are in there, Jim and Jesse and Peter Rowan, who is very articulate about bluegrass singing from being around Monroe. And so that's one of the things I really love about that book. And the other thing was, there's a lot of books that have music notation, and most people in bluegrass don't read music notation. I'm kind of one of them. So I thought of a different system where if the songs are all in the keys that male singers sing in, and that's a weakness, but it's if a male singer will, their most comfortable notes are like the four strings on a banjo, the high D, the B, the G, and the lower D. That's kind of a typical male vocal range. And so if you pitch the songs in G mostly, the melody ends up on the second or third or fourth strings, and those are the same pitches as the guitar second, third, and fourth strings, and the dobro second, third, and fourth strings. So I came up with a three-line form of tablature just for those three strings, and it was unconventional. It's the only time it's ever been used, but the guy at the publishing company said, well, I don't know, let's try it out. So he opens to Angel Band, and he gets out his little guitar, and he's playing Angel Band correctly from the tablature. And a real weakness, though, is that if you're a woman, then you're not going to really want to sing in the key of G, although you can learn the song in G and then transpose it.
Right.
But that was an important
breakthrough,
I thought.
It's a great
because
book.
People just don't use, very few people know how to read standard notation. Now, I have a brand new songbook
that
I worked on with a young fellow named Liam Purcell,
okay.
who has become an award-winning guy. He's a leader of Cane Mill Road, and now he's at Berklee College of Music. And I've known him since he was 10, and he's a really smart kid, great kid. And he started in the JAM program, J-A-M, Junior Appalachian Musicians. He started learning from them when he was 6. And I said to the person in charge of the JAM program, which is a real shoestring operation they have after school programs in 4 different Appalachian states with about 50 places where they do this. And I said, you got them all learning fiddle tunes, don't you? And she said, yeah. I said, you know, songs are a lot easier to learn than fiddle tunes. Do you have any kind of songbook? No. I said, all right, I'm going to make a songbook for the JAM program. And so we put together 39 songs. And instead of using that crazy little tablature thing, we now have a better thing, which is playlists. You can just click over to a playlist online and hear all the songs in the book one after the other.
Well, that's great.
Played by human beings, and you learn them by ear, which is the way we all do.
Right.
We don't read them off a page. Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs never, ever read music. It's all by ear. So this is the first songbook I know that has that feature. And the print is really big, which is an upgrade from that first songbook you mentioned, which was, like, in many cases, too small.
Four songs on a page, or maybe, I don't know.
Well, 2 songs on a page,
yeah.
And just,
I'm going from memory, because I had it. I still have it. I just haven't looked at it in a while. I'm thinking, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, well, take it out, because the songs never go out of date.
They do not. You're right. And yeah, that's the point of it, Pete, is that you've written so many, and you're still putting together. You're always giving back to the music, and I do. I think of you as this mentor that I followed since the 70s when you were. I could get your books and try to learn things, and we kind of blew through the Masters of the 5-string guitar banjo. But that's a great. That was out of print. It was reissued. It's about an inch thick, and it's got all the neat stuff and all the neat little details about all the players. And that's almost like something you have to have.
Yeah, it went out of print for a while, and when they started selling them on eBay for over $200, I convinced a publisher to bring it back in print,
yep.
And we're almost out of that printing, and he doesn't want to do it anymore. He's out of the publishing
Uh-oh.
Business. So we're down to less than 100 copies, and I'm the only person selling them, to my knowledge, unless you find one used someplace. And
well, let's see if we can burn through that 100, then you'll have a new dilemma as to where to get them published.
Well, I'm going to take steps to see if I will be the publisher.
Oh, good. Okay.
I don't know, but we'll see about that. You know, it's got to be worked out. But that was a labor of love. And to me, it's a very special book because, for one thing, I got a chance to have long conversations with some of my heroes, like Alan Shelton and J.D. Crow and John Hartford. And they really, you know, Tony and I came up with a bunch of questions. And we featured 18 players with these long interviews in the book. And then we felt awful because there were so many great players we had excluded. So I took it on myself to create a questionnaire, and I sent it to another 50 of the top banjo players and compiled the results. And it's a pretty exhaustive book where the info ends in about 1986. And at the time, these people were all alive. They were all alive at the time, I believe. And we asked them questions like, were there influences who played banjo? Who were the influences who played other than banjo? What their tailpiece height is?
Well, it's got
how many lessons they took.
Well, and there are photographs, and this always there are photographs of players' right hands. So, and you look at them, you think, oh, I had no idea you could wear picks that close to the end of your fingers or that far down.
Yeah,
and that's how those.
Well,
it was neat.
One of the things I was after was myth busting. Because a lot of people, they see one great banjo player doing something a certain way, and they think that's the way it's done. And, in fact, they're all over the map. One of the biggest myths is that, and I've heard this from a number of teachers, that if you want to be any good on the banjo, you must plant your pinky and your ring finger on the head of the banjo, like Earl did.
Mm-hmm.
And like Earl said to do in his instruction book. But, hey, you know, Jimi Hendrix played left-handed, and he did okay.
On a right-handed guitar.
Yeah. Well, it turns out there's a lot of people whose hand doesn't work that way, and they can only plant one finger. And I had debates with people about whether it's really better to insist that a new player must plant two fingers. And one guy said in print, well, there won't be a good banjo player. And I said, somebody needs to explain this to Alison Brown and Sammy Sheeler and Alan O'Brien. Just let them know they shouldn't be playing the banjo because they can't do that. So we got the data, and the data shows what's really true. Not everybody has a pre-war master tone. People bend their picks differently, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not codified the way, say, cello playing is. There's only one way you're told to play the cello, and it's been worked out for centuries. But the banjo is a relatively, played Scrugg style is still relatively new, and so people learning by ear off the radio, as many of them did, they're going to come up with a lot of stuff, and then after that it's based on desire and musicality and not following exact rules.
Yeah. And so, I love that book. I hope you sell them all out. I love that book, and I hope you get a chance to publish it, and maybe send out some new questionnaires. Because
that's a great idea, and I'm not the one.
You're not the one to do it.
I mean, all these people write with me a brilliant idea. Why don't you do a second book?
Oh.
And I answer back, why don't you?
Because
it's a huge amount of work, and I'm glad I did it, but. It turned out that regular instructional books at the time really outsold this particular book.
Yeah. Although I knew...
The original list price of $30 stopped a lot of people in the 1980s, and the original publisher just let it go out of print when they sold out the first run, and that was very disheartening because I never worked on any book. It was about as hard as I worked on my doctoral thesis, literally.
Pete, I remember...
The thesis didn't sell very well.
No. Pete, I remember people carrying that book around to festivals and events and trying to get... It became a thing. I never did it because I was afraid I would lose my book, but people would get those banjo players to sign their part inside the book. And I thought, what are you doing? They'd have like all these... I thought, well, never occurred to me to do that, but that became a thing to do.
Yeah, well, it's cool. I've signed quite a few books
I'm sure.
And now a lot of the people in the books are not even with us anymore.
Right.
And that makes it that much more of a special thing. And I do hope that some people come along with the drive and the energy to write a book that would include all these people whose careers weren't any place to notice in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes a ridiculous number of great banjo players.
Oh, yeah.
My sister, I'll mention this, my sister was a writer. And she was very well acquainted with the publishing field. And she said, I've never seen a book like that covered any field so very thoroughly as you've covered bluegrass banjo players. And that's what's striking to me. She says there should be a book like that for every discipline. I mean, comedians don't have a book like that. They should, you know. or just anything, you know, people who make shoes, I don't know. So Tony and I felt really good that we were creating this book for the ages.
I was just going to say for the ages, this is a book for the ages. It absolutely is. It's anybody that's ever been interested in banjos or just been a fan of players, it's just a neat thing to have. You can just thumb around in it and focus on your favorite guys. It just are people, not guys, but, you know, players. What a neat book it is. And you just keep doing that stuff, Pete.
I'll tell you what's behind it. First of all, you know, I'm rather educated. I've spent a lot of time in school, and I have an eye for detail, and I'm a geek about banjos, like so many people are. And Tony was always wanting to ask people what kind of strings do you use and everything. And I said, well, we can have meatier questions than that as well. And we put it all in there, expecting for the publisher to edit it like crazy, and they didn't. So the book came out to 431 pages.
Yeah.
And it was a labor of love. I mean, these conversations that we had with these heroes were wonderful. And a lot of them don't really know how to talk very articulately about what they do. But I'll tell you one little story. So J.D. Crowe, as many of us know, at the age of 12, got exposed firsthand to Earl Scruggs quite a bit because Scruggs and his band played right in Lexington where J.D. was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And J.D. was actually into the guitar at first, but then his dad would bring him down to the radio station and plop him right in front of Earl, and he got to watch Earl from like 10 feet away for a whole year, kind of. And that burned a deep impression in his mind, and he worshipped Earl. And so I said, well, did you ever talk to him? And he said, well, I was so frightened of him, you know. And Earl was, of course, a nice guy, but a 12-year-old, you know, feels like he's approaching, Genghis Khan.
Yeah.
And so he said, well, I asked him, how do you make it sound like your notes is a mile apart from each other? Which is the phenomenon that J.D. has always called separation,
right,
where the high definition of the picking is a big part of what gives you the feeling of the playing. And Earl's answer, very typical of Earl, was, I don't know. But then he said, I just try to make every note count. And there is the wisdom of the ages, because if you listen to most amateur players, they don't put the little extra bit of force and definition behind all their notes. So the playing comes out a little blurry.
Right.
And J.D. listened to a banjo player, and he says, oh, that guy's got good separation. It was a primary point. And so having a few things like that scattered around in the book really teaches lessons. And then there are some more articulate players, like Bela Fleck was around, and we got a good interview with him, and so on. And then I even had the idea to say, well, Bill Monroe is the guy who gave all these guys a platform, so he must have opinions about banjo players. So I had done some pretty in-depth interviews with Monroe, and I interviewed him specifically about banjo players. And that was very interesting. You know, he was of two minds about Earl Scruggs. One is he really didn't want to give him any credit because he's sort of a rival in terms of who popularized bluegrass, and he just didn't want to hear of anybody else being the father of bluegrass or whatever. So he said stuff like, there's no telling how much good. He said, Earl was about to go back home to North Carolina, but I gave him a job, and I gave him the kind of music to play that would give him a chance. And he says, there's no telling how much good Molly and Tenbrook's done for Earl Scruggs. And then later in the interview, he softens a little bit. And he says, well, Earl did good for Molly and Tenbrook.
Exactly. I had to figure that was coming somewhere if he was being honest.
So some of the personality stuff gets through, too. And that's not of no interest. You know, you want to know what kind of person will dedicate themselves to playing this kind of music that's not even ever on television or doesn't sell millions of copies, but we're as dedicated as you'll find anybody is. But the money factor is kind of restrained. And oh, did I tell you my Shaka Khan story when we talked?
You
before?
Did.
Should I tell that?
Let's
now?
Do that. Let's do that. And then okay. Then I don't want to keep it too long because I know you're recovering. I know you feel sound great, but tell me the Shaka Khan story one more time.
Well, I'm in a very comfortable position on my couch.
Okay. Let's do the Shaka Khan story.
So back to the year 1991, Hot Rise got a Grammy nomination. So we went, and there's all this hoopla backstage, and one of the things they do is make you get your photo taken and everything. So I'm in a line waiting to get my photo taken, and I realize I'm standing next to Shaka Khan, the very famous R&B, or whatever you might call it, pop singer. And she was with two guys wearing suits, and they were ignoring her, and she was ignoring them. And I thought, well, I could strike up a conversation. So I started with, "You're Shaka Khan, right?" "Yes." "Okay." So we introduce each other, and at one point I say, "Well, what have you been doing lately?" "Okay, well, she's working on her latest album, and she has been flying between London and Berlin and L.A. to make this record." And I say, "Oh, that's really something. You know, we don't have those kind of resources in my kind of music, bluegrass." And she says, "Oh, I like country music." And I said, "No, bluegrass is not exactly synonymous with country music. It's a little anthill compared to a building in... which would be country music, and of course country music is an anthill compared to the pop world."
Right.
And I said, you know, for instance, I said, our records sell really well for bluegrass. It's like 30,000 copies each. And she looks at me with sort of pity, because in her mind, 30,000 would be enough to lose your record deal. And she didn't realize that Sugar Hill thought it was pretty cool we were selling 30K. And then I went on and I said, you know, it's true we don't make much money. Nobody gets rich off of bluegrass, but there's a good side to that, which is if you're wherever you go where there's bluegrass music, you won't find people who are there to make money. They'd leave if they wanted to make a killing. And I'm thinking the two guys in suits next to her are making considerable money just from association with her.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, you know, the only people you run into are people who love the music. Now she's envious of me, and she says, "Oh, that would be so refreshing." And to me, that is sort of like, hurrah, bluegrass won that
game. Right. Right.
And because what's it really about? As we all know, it's not about how much money you make in life. It's about how good a life you have. And if you're with the people that you like and you can avoid people who are not motivated well, you might say. So
that's a great story, Pete, and it makes
know, that,
so much sense. Yeah, go ahead.
That represents my feeling about bluegrass music. I stumbled on it. I'm a New Yorker kid who got into the folk music boom and then found out about Earl Scruggs, and he changed my life that way. And I did the work, and I learned how to do it all, and found out what an incredible community. I like to say, you come for the music and you stay for the people. Because I just tend to like all bluegrass people, whether they have zero education and whether they're their religion is a few degrees off of where mine is. It's just not an issue, because we love so much of the same stuff. It means we have to have a lot of the same values.
Right.
And just being around people who love bluegrass has been wonderful for me since I was a teenager. So it's a community that I think is incredibly valuable, not just to me, but it's one of the most valuable communities, I think, in all of U.S. culture, because it's so real, and it brings people together from all generations, and there's so many good things about bluegrass that way that I love bringing people into it by way of they learn how to jam, and now their social circle changes because they hang out with their jam buddies and not so much the people they work with, you know, or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, to me, a large part of it is all about the community. And, you know, it's what brought you and me together.
Exactly.
We have a lot we can talk about together and compare notes and experiences. So, and these radio shows, you know, I did a radio show in college, and that was a big part of what me helped immerse me in the bluegrass community.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, you were in New York. I remember talking about that. Pete, it's just always a pleasure to speak with you, and I do miss not seeing you over the years, and I'm sorry that it took you to have a heart attack for me to call you and say how you doing, but at least I did.
It's a good way to get attention. I don't recommend it, but now that I've been in both a plane crash that
yep.
was very, very costly to a lot of people's lives,
yeah, it's very sad.
And luckily me and my family survived, but I couldn't believe the attention I got after that, and now having a heart attack is more conventional, you might say, because a lot of people get heart attacks, but it certainly brought out some concern and put me back in touch with a whole bunch of people that I'd known or I sort of know, and I just felt really buoyed by the community feeling and the concern. So you're part of that, and I appreciate it, and your listeners, I hope, found something interesting there.
Yeah, right.
I was about to launch into some more stories, but there's probably a need to play some music in your show.
At some point, they like to have some music, and I'm going to play some Hot Rise. I'm going to play some of your other Plexigrass and all that other Plexigrass. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I've got all kinds
of
people.
Those bands still exist, although they're not very active, and Hot Rise is going to be featured, kind of the main headliner, at a big festival with some great people on it, the Rocky Grass Festival this summer, where they're celebrating the 50th annual festival in Colorado of the Rocky Grass Festival. And because we go back to the first years of the festival and we're still playing, that they figured we were the ones to headline. So
sure.
We're very honored to do that, and it means that we have to get our act together. And I got to practice a bunch of stuff that I haven't been playing very much, but that's a good thing.
It is a good thing. Pete, you sound great, man. You sound absolutely ready to go, and you sound real good. I know you're going to follow through on all your medical advice.
And, yes,
you'll be right back. You'll be right back in the groove again, and I can't wait to see you down the road. Thanks, Pete, for always being accessible
for
this program.
Thank you for your encouragement,
too. Sure, you're welcome. You're welcome. I will talk to you. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I look forward to some other time when we can just yak it up some more.
Just sit and chat.
Or whatever.
Yeah, we'll do it. I'll find you. All right?
All right, my friend.
Thank you
very much for the call, and hope your listeners enjoyed at least some of it.
Oh, I think they will. They will. Pete Mornick, thanks, man. And by the way, belated happy birthday by the time this airs. When I called you last Friday, it was your birthday, but so here we are.
Yes, sir.
There you go. You're still
I'm going to try to have some more of those.
I hope so. All right, Pete. Take care of yourself, my friend.
Hey, you too.
I love Pete Wernick. He's been a friend for so long and a mentor, as we discussed. Goes back to the 70s when I first picked up a banjo. Maybe he doesn't want credit for that influence. Maybe not. I mean, I bought all of his books and Hot Rise. They were cool. They did all kinds of great music. Yeah, thanks so much, Pete. Thanks so much for tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass. I do appreciate it.